Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed. Thursday means it is Author of the Week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, where you can, of course, go get any of the Author of the Week books that we have. And then we do have also, if you miss any past interviews with authors, you can go to ksgf.com in the podcast section, Author of the Week. It's a great resource for you as you try to decide what book is going to be the next book for you to read. And we have the author this morning, D. Trans, True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult. Mary Margaret Olihan is with us. And I want to thank you for being with us this morning. This is an issue that I talk about quite often on the show for a number of different reasons. And if we could start off, what prompted you, compelled you to write on this particular subject?
Well, it's a story, and I guess I should say stories, that the establishment media don't want to tell. And, you know, in my job as a conservative reporter, I view that largely as my job to tell the stories that aren't being told. Establishment media leaves this huge hole in our media coverage where there's all these different stories, whether it has to do with COVID or abortion or coverage of Republican candidates or things like that, that just are not told. And so when I started learning about detransitioners and how all these young people had gone through transitions or attempted transitions that they later deeply regretted, I thought, this is something that we need to dive into more. We need to share specifically their stories so that people can understand what they've been through. And I truly believe that these stories are what is changing the tide on this gender ideology movement. Mm. You know, they're real stories. So that's what the book is. It's light on the commentary, heavy on the stories. And I really wanted to give people a good glimpse into exactly what happened, why these young people were motivated to seek such irreversible procedures, and what made them realize that it was impossible what they had attempted.
Well, let's talk about what motivates them. And to me, this is one of the most macabre and tragic aspects of this, is it's not necessarily that we're talking about, you know, otherwise healthy young people, but people who are in need. And they're sold what seems to me to be this horrific, irreversible, what they're told is a cure. And I can't imagine anything more devastating if you are already, whether it's because of abuse or, you know, bullying or whatever the reason may be, feeling very insecure, thinking that there is no hope. And then you're told by someone that is an authority, oh, there is hope. And then only to find out not only was that a lie, but you have done irreversible damage to yourself physically and emotionally. It just seems like one of the cruelest things that is imaginable. So what is it that you have found with these stories leads some of these young people into this decision that they feel is the best one for them and their mental health?
Yes, I found that many of these young people were first exposed to gender ideology on the internet. You know, they were largely, and I'm generalizing here, so this isn't true of every single person, but these are just general themes that I've noticed. Oftentimes, these young people are struggling in school. They're lonely. They might have parents going through divorce or one parent that's struggling with their mental health in a certain way. Often with the girls, there's some kind of assault in their background where they were assaulted by someone. And many of these young people have told me that they were on the spectrum, or they believe that they were on the spectrum, but they were never diagnosed. And what will happen is they are lonely, so they turn to the internet and they look for companionship there. And unfortunately, there are way too many predators online who are far too easily accessible for young people. And so they'll stumble on these pro-transgender groups or pro-transgender pages. And what they'll be told is, oh, you're lonely, you feel like you don't fit in. That's probably because you are in the wrong body. And once the young people latch on to this idea, they potentially become obsessive about it, which is something that many people who are on the spectrum experience, is more obsessive behaviors about certain things. And so they'll really fixate on this, and the activists will tell them, if anyone tells you that you're not a different gender, you know, you're not transgender, then they hate you and they want you dead. And they really foster this attitude in these young people that they must be accepted by the family, their families and their loved ones, or else their families and their loved ones hate them and want them dead, which is a very evil and manipulative thing to do. And part of the reason that I used this phrase, gender ideology cult, because I think you can see the cult-like aspects in trying to cut someone off from everyone that they love that might try and stop them from attempting these gender transitions. And so oftentimes what will take place is that the young people will decide, all right, I am transgender, and they'll begin using a different name, different pronouns, and the school that they're attending will likely affirm them and affirm this change. And the children, because these are children that we're talking about when they're minors, they will go to their parents and say, I want to get these gender transition procedures, because they need their parents' consent. Or they did until recently. Some places now will help the children facilitate gender transitions without parental consent. And so once the children go to the parents generally love their children and care about them. And we know for sure that there are parents out there who, for selfish and narcissistic reasons, will try and transition their child or tell their child that they're transgender in an effort to promote themselves, the parents. That's definitely something that we see happen, especially with young kids like toddlers who the parents claim are transgender. Right. But I think largely what we see is parents of, you know, average Americans who love their children, and their kids come to them and say, I think I'm transgender. And the parents don't know what to do because they're not super politically keyed into the political conversations. And so what they do is they go to the doctor and they seek the help of medical professionals, such as therapists or doctors or mental health professionals. And almost always what they're told is you need to affirm your child, or else they might be at risk of hurting themselves or committing suicide. And what all of these detransitioners told me when I was interviewing them was that their parents were asked, would you rather have a dead daughter or a living son? Or in the case of the boys, would you rather have a dead son or a living daughter? And that's a threat that's made to parents. It is intended to scare them and make them feel that if they don't affirm their child, their kid will kill themselves and it will be their fault. It's just a really horrible, horrible, evil lie that is sold to parents. It's not true. And so the parents, they're thinking, okay, well, the mental health professionals are telling me I have to do this or my kid will kill themselves. So they go along with it. And they consent to these procedures to be done. And the often young girls will begin testosterone injections, which have really severe effects upon their muscle growth, their bone density, their hair, their skin, their emotions, their fertility, their sexual function. All of these things are very much impacted by the hormones. And then after a certain period of time, for the girls, there's an expectation that they will get a double mastectomy. And for most of these girls, they really haven't had an experience dating boys. They have never kissed a boy. Some of them had never even held hands with a boy. But these doctors and therapists are encouraging them to view themselves as, you know, a completely different gender, and to explore their sexual preferences when they might not even really have any yet, considering they're young teens and they don't really understand what they're getting into. And as their lawsuits are now saying, they weren't really able to fully give informed consent to these types of procedures, given that they didn't know what they were getting into. They weren't given all the information. And a lot of these hormonal injections are experimental, as the release of the WPATH files, the World Professional Transgender Health Association, has recently shown. The expose of those files showed that these supposedly expert doctors involved in WPATH know that the hormones are giving some girls tumors, and they know that the hormones are ruining some girls' fertility. And they know that some of these girls are not able to fully consent to the procedures because of their mental health issues, which, by the way, every single detransitioner had when they began this process. So we're seeing a whole bunch of lawsuits coming out recently of detransitioners suing their medical providers and saying, I was not able to fully consent to this. You lied to me. You pushed me down this path. And now I understand that all of this was manipulation and lies, and you were the ones that sold it to me.
We were talking with our author of the week, Mary Margaret Olihan. The book is Detrans, True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult. Our author of the week interview was sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone. One of the, what I understand anyhow, as I read more, particularly from the mouths of those who have been through this, is that they're told, well, this is all irreversible, that you don't have to worry about forever changing yourself. Essentially, there's no risk here, ultimately. Did you find when you interviewed these different young people who are detransing that they also had been led to believe that some of the changes were reversible, rather, if they changed their mind, or was that something that came up?
Well, for starters, we have to remember that these young people who are undergoing these transition procedures are largely, like, deeply struggling with their mental health. So they're not in a good place to be understanding right. whether things are reversible or irreversible to begin with. But in many cases, they say that the doctors didn't really explain to them whether or not things were experimental or whether or not they were reversible. It was more of a matter of, you'll be happy if you undergo these transition procedures because it will relieve your gender dysphoria. So for the girls, many of these girls, they didn't understand that their fertility might be impacted. Nobody talked about that. And even if they could, even if the doctors had explained that their fertility might be impacted, these are kids, so they don't understand right. what that means. Chloe Cole, for example, had never considered whether she wanted to breastfeed her children one day. It's just not something that little girls typically are thinking about or looking forward to. It's just not on their mind. But doctors didn't even bring this up to her when she got her double mastectomy. It was just, you know, fast-tracked, and right. she went through the procedure, and now she no longer has breasts. And that's a huge implication for a woman, you know, who she didn't know whether she even wanted to have a family one day. She hadn't really considered it. So that was taken away from her, and when she could not fully consent to it. But I think even worse than that, there were girls there's been reports in the media that there were girls who didn't understand that their breasts were gone forever. There were some girls who naively, whether from naivete or from their mental health issues, believed their breasts would grow back. And that's the level of not understanding that was going on here, where these kids are thinking, they don't understand biology apparently, right. but they also are thinking, oh, this isn't irreversible, this will come back. And you know, you can see how it could be even worse with the hormones, which are injected into your body and have stealth implications that you might not be aware of for quite some time.
With your time writing for the Daily Wire, the Daily Caller, now senior reporter covering culture and politics for the Daily Signal, you clearly were aware of, to some degree, what was going on. Of course, that's what prompted you to write the book. Were there stories from some of these individuals that you found yourself thinking, man, I knew it was bad, but I didn't know it was this bad?
Oh, for sure. I think I knew largely the big picture details of their stories, which are, of course, upsetting and you know, very demoralizing. But for me, the hardest part of writing this book was to ask some of these really intimate questions about some of the most vulnerable moments. I made sure to ask everyone that underwent a surgery, what were you thinking right before you went under? Do you remember? And, you know, when you opened your eyes, who did you see and what did you think and what was your drive home like? Things like that I think are really important for understanding where their head was at and what these moments were like for them. For Chloe Cole, for example, she told me that right before she went under, she was looking across the room and she saw this guy that was, you know, a nurse or something, standing across from her, and he had this really weird expression on his face, and he was staring at her like he was very troubled. And she doesn't know what he was thinking, but she wondered at the time, or she wonders now, whether he was looking at her and thinking, what are we doing? This is a little girl that's about to undergo a double mastectomy. And then she went under, and she doesn't remember anything else because she did undergo a double mastectomy. Another really raw moment was Precious shared with me that after her surgery, she also underwent a double mastectomy. When she woke up, her parents had to take her back to the hotel where she was going to recover because her surgery was done in an outpatient facility, so she couldn't stay there. And they took her back to the hotel, and she said they had Chick-fil-A that night. And she says she remembers it spilled in the car, and her dad was upset. And then they ate Chick-fil-A at the hotel. And she said that in the weeks following, her mom had to wash her wounds because they needed to be washed and dressed. And she said she couldn't raise her arms because of the recovery period, and she really needed help. And she described her mom washing her wounds for the first time, and she said they both cried. And they were both like deeply moved by this, which is so sad. You know, you imagine this mother who loves her daughter and didn't know whether this was the right decision, and now she has to help her daughter through this next part. It's just tragic.
Yeah, you mentioned those files from that organization, and I read through some of those, and without getting too graphic, I remember a part that, again, even though I'm aware of what has been going on, but still it sort of stopped me in my tracks. And it was the acknowledgement that when there is the surgical attempt to reconstruct a male body part into a female body part, and how some of the individuals that this is done to, they have to, on a daily basis, tend to that, because what is happening is the body is trying to heal itself, and they are essentially forced to every day try and stop the body from healing itself. And there's just something about that, knowing that that's what your body is trying to fix what was done to it. And then you are instructed by medical professionals, no, you have to fight against your own body's attempt to heal itself.
Right. It's so wrong. And without getting too graphic, I think that that type of story is really illustrative of how confusing this whole thing has become, where our body knows how to heal itself. Our body knows how to take care of ourselves. That was how our bodies were created to function. And yet we've come to this kind of Frankenstein point where some of our doctors and medical professionals have taken it upon themselves to try and craft fake or phantom body parts. And they don't work, and they try and heal. And that should be a good sign to us that these things are not meant to be. But unfortunately, we just keep pushing the envelope in that area.
Well, I appreciate you being with us this morning, and I appreciate the book as well, because I know that those that they do know this is wrong, and they have a sense of the manipulation that's taking place, but the horrors, and you're right, the Frankenstein style, this sort of just, it's a dark horror movie scenario where these people are just experimenting on living individuals and convincing them if they don't go through with it, then they may kill themselves. I just can't think of any darker moment in our history. And it seems as if the rest of the world they're slowly kind of figuring this out, while we're way behind the curve on that. And we used to be a country that prided ourselves on being ahead of the curve with these sorts of things, particularly when it comes to science and medicine. So it's just such a horrible thing on a micro level and on a macro level. And I think it's important for people to read the stories of these real life victims. Our author of the week, sponsored by ABC Books, Mary Margaret Olihan, the book D-Trans, True Stories of Escaping the Gender Ideology Cult, Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed.